This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thanks so much for listening. On today's show, we're going to talk about image. We'll explore a public health campaign in New York City designed to encourage a positive body image for young girls. And the question is, can it work? And we'll hear about how healthcare options are looking on day three of the Affordable Care Act. But here in Washington, where I am, there's a very different image question at play. As we all know, we are in day three of the government shutdown. And one thing that you notice right away in the House chamber, in the Senate press conferences, anywhere around town, is that this fight is quickly becoming more an image battle than a policy battle. As soon as the clock ticked past midnight on Monday, the politicians ran not into the negotiating room, but for the cameras, to win a media-fueled battle for the war of public opinion. And they ran to Washington's World War II Memorial to get photographed sympathizing with elderly veterans barred by nasty politicians from visiting their monument. Listen here to Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus, who, along with politicians of both parties, showed up at the memorial yesterday.
Make no mistake, it was the Obama administration's choice to barricade this memorial. And it was their choice to lock out veterans across this country.
Well, we want to dissect the government shutdown image war, and we thought this is a job for Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you.
And I'm glad that you're here. Let's not be naive. All politics is about optics to an extent. But a shutdown fight is really different. It's been remarkable to me that the second the shutdown happened, it's not about Obamacare, it's not about spending levels, it's about the cameras, isn't it?
It's also about the language. We talk about government shutdown, but in fact, the government hasn't shut down. It'd be more accurate to say the government slowed down. We furloughed over 800,000 workers, but essential services are being preserved as best they can with the available resources. It's also interesting to say what is essential and not, because we're talking about essential versus non-essential, and those veterans thought getting to their memorial was essential. However, in the meantime, there's a question about whether new disability requests for veterans will be processed, and we don't have cameras on that because it's harder to visualize.
But it's sure easy to visualize a closed sign around a fence or an honorable veteran not being able to get into a granite memorial.
It is. And so the question is, are the things that are easy to picture the things that necessarily let us understand the issue and what government actually does and why we value it? I mean, this is an important, moment in which we can ask, what are all those things that we simply take for granted that we actually do pay for with taxpayers' dollars that are being slowed down and as a result not delivered as efficiently, effectively, or immediately as we might like, such as OSHA inspections and mine inspections and import-export, inspections, clinical trials run by the National Institutes of Health and the like.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned clinical trials, because listen to this moment from yesterday in the Senate press gallery between a CNN reporter and Harry Reid, and I really want to dissect this. Listen.
But if you can help one child with cancer, why wouldn't you do it?
Listen.
Why
would we want to do that? I have 1,100 people at Nellis Air Force Base that are sitting home.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, immediately after Harry Reid said that, Twitter and the internet and even a lot of cable networks on television blew up with the idea that Harry Reid really doesn't like kids with cancer. A guy, not defending Harry Reid, but he's probably voted for every National Cancer Institute bill that ever was. Republicans today are holding a press conference on what? Child pediatric cancer.
And in the process, they are raising the visibility of government work in those kinds of areas. And the question is, can we get past the single example, the child who may not get access to the needed cancer drug, to the larger question, what does the government do in this sector? How does it contribute overall to our well-being and to the economy? And when we get to those abstractions, it's much more difficult for the press to explain. It's much more difficult for the country to understand. But that's actually what government does. Government helps those children individually as it creates medical breakthroughs. But collectively, it contributes to the national well-being in ways that go substantially beyond that child. Harry Reid phrased that poorly, but he was making a larger point. We need to think in aggregate here, not in terms of the specific compelling example only.
And as you walk around the Capitol and around Washington, Kathleen Hall Jamison, I'm sorry to say, it really appears that the politicians want us to think about just one thing, Just blame. That's all they're really concerned about, or so it seems at this point. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Kathleen, keep watching that shutdown. We will be.
Slow down.
Slow down. Thanks so much. Well, as long as we're talking about images here, here's one for you. Cutting off your nose to spite your face? That's the current government shutdown. How about cutting off your whole head? That might be what happens if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling. Back in September, the U.S. Treasury warned Congress that if the nation's debt limit isn't raised by October 17th, the U.S. will run out of cash to pay off its debts. And according to the Bipartisan Partisan Center, on October 18th, the U.S. government will find itself $106 billion short on its payments through mid-November, and that means that nearly a third of funds owed would go unpaid. Well, that's a scenario that economists say could cause massive economic turmoil, not just here in the U.S., but in bond markets all over the world. And now, as though the problem weren't bad enough, Washington watches as this government shutdown morphs and melds into an even bigger political problem that's raising the debt ceiling. James Surowiecki is a financial columnist for The New Yorker. He talked to me about why we have a debt ceiling in the first place.
Well, it's really a historical artifact. It was really the product of Congress's desire to ensure that the executive did not sort of spend money that had not been authorized. And so there was this idea that you would have this debt ceiling, which limits the amount of money that the federal government can borrow, and that that would serve as a check. But the reality is that reforms that happen in the way money gets appropriated and authorized, reforms that really kind of crystallized in the 1970s, essentially made the debt limit irrelevant, because Congress now very explicitly sets out, as you said, both what can be authorized and then appropriates the money for it. And then the executive branch, the president, is responsible for obviously going ahead and actually spending it. But basically, Congress controls the spending process from beginning to end. And so the debt limit, in a way, is an anachronism. And unfortunately, it is, as we're seeing now, an incredibly dangerous anachronism.
Well, we have a situation now where Republicans in Congress, conservatives most specifically, want concessions. They want some policy concessions in order to agree to raise the debt limit. They want a lot of different things. Some things are connected to the debt. Many of them aren't. Is there something wrong with that? I mean, in politics, you use your leverage. What's wrong with using the debt limit to get what you want?
Well, I think there are two big problems. The first is that, generally speaking, you don't want representatives of a country holding that country hostage in order to get policy. Obviously, you want people to use leverage, but you don't want the leverage to be, if you don't give us what we want, we are going to potentially send the country into a profound financial crisis. I think by any measure, that would be seen as congressional malpractice. And the funny thing is, no one, literally, I think, thinks that breaching the debt ceiling would be a good idea. Everyone agrees it would be a disaster. The Republicans are just, in effect, saying we're willing to risk disaster to get what we want. The second problem, which I think is really important to recognize, is that what Republicans are trying to use the debt ceiling to do is basically subvert the entire legislative process. You know, we know the way laws are supposed to get passed in the United States. A majority in Congress, both houses, passes the law. The president signs it. If the president vetoes and you have a veto-proof majority, you can override the veto. And that's what happened with Obamacare, which is really the linchpin of the Republican effort to use the debt ceiling as leverage. But Republicans don't like Obamacare, and they want to use the debt ceiling to, in effect, repeal it. But that basically means that any time a minority, which controls one house, doesn't like a policy, it can use the debt ceiling as hostage to get what it wants. That's a total perversion of majoritarian democracy. And I think it's a terrible idea, even if you set aside the fact that they are potentially risking economic catastrophe to get what they want.
Well, let's talk about that economic catastrophe. We did the politics. What about the financials of a debt limit? We know that if the debt limit's breached, the Treasury can't borrow. And I know that that's connected to Treasury bonds, that the Treasury issues bonds to pay on debt. What happens if we go beyond October 17th with no increase in the debt limit? What's the real world scenario here?
Well, the thing that's so painful about this is that it's purely self-inflicted, right? The United States has no trouble borrowing money. People are willing to lend us money at incredibly low interest rates. And in fact, even if people weren't, we have the Federal Reserve, which can print money and buy debt, which it has been doing. So there's no reason from a financial perspective for this to be happening. We would be choosing to, in effect, hurt ourselves. Now, in terms of how we would hurt ourselves, part of what's scary is we don't know exactly what would happen, because one of the real paradoxes here is that if we don't raise the debt ceiling and we can't borrow the money, we essentially would be able to pay some of our bills but not all of them. We would have enough money coming in from tax revenue to pay some of our bills but not all of them. And so the question is, well, what happens then? Who decides what bills to pay? There's no law saying that the president has the authority to do that. And the problem is that that uncertainty is incredibly dangerous. The second problem is that whether or not we pay the interest on the debt or if we just don't pay our bills, we would in effect be defaulting. And that is obviously going to send shockwaves through the system, because the whole point of the U.S. Treasuries for the global economy has been that they are the risk-free asset. You don't have to worry about anything going wrong with U.S. Treasuries. And we would, in effect, be making something go wrong with U.S. Treasuries. And that would probably send interest rates skyrocketing over time. The other scary thing is that Treasuries are used in the kind of the innards of the financial system all over the world as collateral. People use them to essentially borrow other money and the rest of it. If those treasuries are suddenly a little sketchy, it's possible that that will kind of freeze up the system. We don't know what will happen, but none of it is going to be good.
Pleadings and advice from James Surowiecki, financial columnist for The New Yorker. James, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Todd.
Well, later this hour, we're talking about a new campaign in New York City that's trying to redefine the idea of beauty for young girls. And we're asking you, how has your body image changed over time? And what's changed about it? From Seattle, Washington, we got this text. The biggest change is that I now celebrate my body for the amazing things it does for me. And I don't beat myself up anymore for not being thin enough, cute enough. I have heard that healthy is the new skinny, and I hope that that catches on. And a listener from Hudson, Wisconsin wrote, I became aware of it in eighth grade when a boy said I had a big butt. And I've been aware of it ever since. Everything I buy fits a certain way, hiding the extra pounds. Media pushes women to be beyond thin. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be part of this conversation. Find us also on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Well, coming up, Congress may be holding the Affordable Care Act hostage, but one uninsured American tells us why he's looking forward to Obamacare.
No, I want my insurance. I would love to be able to take advantage of this opportunity to get insurance at an affordable level, and it seems like they're bound and determined to ensure that I don't.
The exchanges are up and running. We go to Oklahoma to find out how they're working for one uninsured man. That's coming up on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry, who will be live in Charlotte, North Carolina tomorrow. Well, here in D.C., we may be in the middle of a government shutdown, but the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, still debuted as planned this week. The online marketplaces, those exchanges, are up and running, with about 2.8 million people visiting the federal website healthcare.gov on day one, and millions more checking in on sites provided by their local and state governments. Well, Hugh Meade was among them. He's a carpenter and an independent sign contractor in Oklahoma City. Hugh has been priced out of buying health insurance for much of the last 10 years, but on Tuesday he did log in to the online exchange, hoping to find some coverage he can afford. And because of the risky nature of his work in that sign shop, Hugh says he's anxious to get some coverage again.
So specifically for me, because I work around power tools, you know, table saws and drills and planers and things that could really do me some pretty serious damage. And I think about it every time I turn one of those machines on. Of course, I'm careful and I wear safety goggles and protective gear. But a lot of the older guys that I work around are missing parts of their fingers or whole fingers. And, you know, a single incident like that would be disastrous, to keep me from working for a period of time, to, you know, just trying to keep up with those medical bills. I think about it all the time.
Well, Hugh, you sound like just the guy that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is designed to reach, right? You're self-employed. And right. How long has it been since you've had health insurance?
9 of the past 10 years, my employers did not offer me any option for health insurance. And so I had had to look into it on my own as an individual, and it was just, prohibitively expensive. For instance, to cover really just myself, not including my wife or my son, was going to be, from my research, around $600 a month, which is very close to what my mortgage payment is.
Well, boy, I know every bit of your story is true, Hugh, but you really sound like sort of the poster child for the Affordable Care Act. The White House would love to have your testimonial here. You're the guy that they want to jump on the website and look for the exchanges in your
right.
state, not just want. I guess you kind of have to. Everybody has to have insurance.
Right.
So walk me through how it's been. Have you dipped your toe in the Obamacare pool yet?
Right. So yesterday morning, or probably around 8 o'clock, I did start to get online and look at the website. You know, it took me a minute. It actually occurred to me as I was looking that I didn't know what the website was called. And I don't know if that's just me not paying attention or a failure of, you know, promotion, but I guess it's healthcare.gov is where I wound up. And I did see the exchanges, and it asked me for information, my age and gender and, you know, some basic health questions. I don't use tobacco products, for example. And then it popped up with a list from least expensive to most expensive of quite a lot, actually, of available policies. Most of them were still over $300, but there were several that were in the, you know, $185 to $191 range that I saw that seemed like they'd be appropriate for me and would give me adequate coverage to at least make me feel like, you know, I'm not hanging in the wind when it comes to medical bills.
Well, getting back to your family, Hugh, your wife has had some significant health issues in the past, some back issues and stuff, as I understand it. We talked about your insurance. What about insurance for your wife? One thing that Obamacare does is say the insurance companies can't deny you for pre-existing conditions, but they can sure charge you a lot more if you're already sick.
Right. So specifically what happened to my wife was she had a prolapsed disc in her spine, her lower back, that protruded in and was crushing the spinal cord at the bottom. We were uninsured at the time, you know, both fairly healthy and, you know, late 30s, not terribly concerned about it. And getting treatment was a real problem. It turns out my misconception, and I think a lot of people's, is that if you go to an emergency room in America, they have to treat you. Which is true, whether or not you're insured, but all they're required to do is stabilize you. And so what they would do is alleviate the immediate pain and then bounce her. And it took 28 days to finally get on our own an appointment with a neurosurgeon. And we also had to find and pay for an MRI on our own. She was in excruciating pain for that amount of time and in bed the entire time. And as soon as the neurosurgeon put the films up on his light box, he turned to her and said, "We need to get you in the operating room right now." She still has some residual effects from that, you know, numbness and loss of sensation. But she's okay. However, you know, the bills were in the range of $30,000, and we're still seeing the effects of it in our finances. And it makes it even more imperative that I become insured. Now, she is partially disabled, and so she pays for and receives Medicare.
Well, Hugh, as you continue to navigate the exchange, I guess the federal exchange, the frontier of Obamacare here, how are you feeling about it? You know, you're about to get insurance, I guess. Is this a new day for you economically, or just sort of a, you know, another decision, you'll get covered and kind of move on with your life?
Well, I mean, I kind of hope it is just sort of, you know, well, great, now I can be covered and I can stop, you know, really thinking about that. I don't think it's going to really change my life unless, of course, there's some, you know, incident where I'm covered. So it will be a relief to me, but I probably won't dwell on it much after that.
Hugh, my final question before we let you go is, you watch this government shutdown business going on in Washington. What do you say to yourself when you see a lot of politicians who want to defund or get rid of Obamacare and are sort of using a government shutdown as part of that fight?
It makes me angry. I think this is not how grown-ups are supposed to make decisions and negotiate. It's an established law. This is not how we change or alter laws in the United States. My understanding is that there is a method for doing that, and it's not holding the budget of the United States government hostage in order to get what you want.
Hugh, why do you think that so many of the politicians here think that their constituents think Obamacare is so very bad when for somebody like you, it seems like it's pretty important?
I think it's regrettable that as a country, we've fallen into this morass of political grandstanding is what it seems like to me. And it bothers me. No, I want my insurance. I would love to be able to take advantage of this opportunity to get insurance at an affordable level. And it seems like they're bound and determined to ensure that I don't have that opportunity.
Hugh Mead, shopping for insurance on the exchanges under the Affordable Care Act as that law gets underway. Hugh Mead is owner of Odd Fab Design Lab right there in Oklahoma City. Hugh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, D.C., filling in for John Hockenberry today. You know, we've been talking about the government shutdown and the Affordable Care Act, but really, you know, a lot of the battle over Obamacare hasn't been going on in Washington at all. It's been going on in the states and to some extent much more important. 26 states, all of them controlled by Republicans, have rejected the Medicaid expansion component of the ACA. Now, the Medicaid expansion extends Medicaid eligibility to all people living underneath 138% of the federal poverty level, and that includes folks bringing in $26,000 a year for a family of three and just over $15,000 for an individual. Well, that Medicaid expansion also covers groups currently left out of public health care coverage, including low-income adults without children and many low-income people with disabilities. Well, according to some new data analyzed by our partner, the New York Times, of the 26 states rejecting that Medicaid expansion, roughly two-thirds of the nation's uninsured working poor live in those very states. Joining us on the line to help explain these numbers, Sabrina Tavernisi, health reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi there.
Well, what does it mean for these millions of people in these states? You know, Obamacare had a Medicaid expansion. The Supreme Court said part that you don't have to do that. Many states have rejected it. So if you live in one of those states on the margins, what does it really mean for them?
So essentially what's happening is that, you know, people are going online and going to find out what their subsidy might be on the exchanges or if they might qualify for any type of health coverage. And what they're finding, as one of the people in my story, Robin, found, was that the computer spits out that she's eligible for no subsidies and that she is not eligible for Medicaid because her state has not expanded Medicaid. So that's kind of a rude surprise because it's a strange situation in which people who are earning slightly more are actually going to be getting subsidies on the exchanges, but people who are below poverty, so for the purposes of Medicaid, that's about $11,490 a year per person, they are not eligible for anything at all. So unless they currently qualify for Medicaid in their individual states, and some of the states that have rejected the expansions, the income ceiling is very low. So, you know, you have to basically, in Mississippi, for example, it's just 29% of the poverty level. That's the income, and that's only for parents. So if you don't have dependent children, you're really essentially out of luck.
Well, that's a little bit confusing to me, though, Sabrina Tavernisi, because I thought that in states that don't have a Medicaid expansion, there was supposed to be a seamless transition, that if you don't qualify for Medicaid, but you're still poor, that the subsidies were supposed to cover you.
So the subsidies will cover people above poverty. If you're making above that line, then you have the option of having subsidies on the exchanges. But if you're below, you don't.
You don't qualify for any subsidies at all.
That's right. Unless you qualify for the current Medicaid in its current form in your individual state.
What about the individual mandate? Is it the case that these folks we're talking about still have to get insurance but get no help, or are they just still left without insurance?
they're left without insurance. They won't be fined for not having it, as the law calls for. But people below poverty and above the current Medicaid ceiling are not going to be eligible for financial help.
And as this battle over defunding or repealing or delaying Obamacare goes on here in Washington, Sabrina Tavernisi, it doesn't appear that these actions against Medicaid expansion are going anywhere in the states. Now, that's Sabrina Tavernisi. She's health reporter for our partner, The New York Times, reporting for us and analyzing the data that 26 states that have rejected the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare, that roughly 2/3 of the nation's uninsured working poor live in those states. That's millions of people. Sabrina, thank you.
Thank you very much.
These days, everybody uses Wikipedia online, right? It's a name, really, that's associated, though, with volume of information, not necessarily accuracy. What if you got medical information, though, from Wikipedia? Would you use it? There's a new effort being pursued at the University of California at San Francisco where med students are going to be able to get some course credit for editing Wikipedia articles about different diseases. The goal here is to improve the quality of that medical information available globally with the intent that the updated articles are going to be translated into hundreds of different languages worldwide and made available on cell phones free of charge through the help of the Wikimedia Foundation. Now, the doctor at the head of this effort is Dr. Amin Azam. He's associate clinical professor at UCSF there in San Francisco and joins us now. He's teaching a one-month course of Wikipedia editing this December. Hi, Doc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Well, like I said, Wikipedia is not necessarily heralded for accuracy. And in the world of medicine, boy, with clinical information, accuracy is pretty important. How do these two things square with you?
I think it's important to acknowledge that Wikipedia has gone through a lot of changes through its life cycle. And I certainly agree with you that the medical content of Wikipedia is relatively less accurate than, say, other areas of Wikipedia. And I think part of that is because the health professional community hasn't really gotten on board in the way that a lot of other people have in the value of contributing to Wikipedia. So we have a long ways to go with the accuracy of the information, and that's a big part of what I'm hoping to achieve with the elective.
Well, how did you get the idea to actually give the students credit for getting on Wikipedia and putting in better information?
So one of my former students warned me to this idea. And as I learned more about it and thinking and talking about it with him, came to realize there was a lot of untapped opportunity to embrace Wikipedia in a way that our students have been doing for years. It's just that we as faculty have to catch up with them.
So the med students sit in class, they're getting instruction in, you know, clinical subjects, of course, treating diseases, anatomy, and then for your course, they go back to the apartment or the coffee shop and get on the laptop and put what they know onto Wikipedia. Is that sort of how it works?
Yes, I think that's right. We will be working with fourth-year medical students, so these students will have already spent all of those classroom years, and they've all will have already spent at least 1 year in different parts of the hospital and clinics, having real patient encounters as the predominant acts of their days. As fourth-year med students, oftentimes they are selecting what kind of doctors they want to be. They're going to be going to different parts of the country interviewing for their residencies. So we chose December because that's a month in the calendar year when many of them are off interviewing around the country. So it's a travel-friendly elective that allows them to be getting academic credit while they're literally editing Wikipedia on the plane.
Now, what about on the other end? I get what the students are going to be doing. What's the intent on the other end, the user end of this information?
I think, as you said, everyone uses Wikipedia. It's the fifth most trafficked website on the planet these days. And the fact that it is so heavily used speaks to the value of the information that individuals believe they're getting when they go to Wikipedia. So my hope is that the people who choose to seek out medical information online will find that Wikipedia's information is more accurate and written at an appropriate level for the broad public. There are certainly other places that doctors can go to get information. Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, the World Health Organization, for example, those are oftentimes written by doctors for doctors. And what Wikipedia will allow us to do is have that information written at the appropriate depth and breadth and level, and as you said earlier, accuracy for the general public. This is where people are going for information. So I really feel like we should join people where they are rather than expecting them to come to us in our ivory towers.
One of the liabilities of Wikipedia is that once you change it, somebody can change it back. I suppose there's a chance that your med students will put great information on Wikipedia and somebody else will come along and make it not so great.
Absolutely true. I think that is both the double-edged sword of Wikipedia is the democratization of and the ability of all to add to Wikipedia is why it has become so popular and prevalent. I would offer that if the entire health professional community were engaged with this process, we would actually be able to counterbalance some of those inaccuracies because we all as a profession are committed to accurate information and helping the health of the public, regardless of any efforts at undermining what's there.
Bringing better medical information to where you are, not in the hallowed halls of the National Institutes of Health or your doctor's office, but how about right on your iPhone? Dr. Amin Azam, Associate Clinical Professor at UCSF in San Francisco, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to the show. It's another year rocked by mass shootings and gun-related deaths, but not all of those shootings that you hear so much about happen on purpose. Take this headline from the Huffington Post just yesterday. Man accidentally shoots off gun in pants during hug, accidentally kills girlfriend. Or this story from earlier in the year. Five-year-old shoots sister with birthday rifle. According to our partner, the New York Times, accidental shooting deaths occur roughly twice as often as official records indicate. Now, these aren't mass shootings or even intentional shootings. They're just accidents. And with Congress at a standstill over how to pass tougher background checks on guns, some developers are working on efforts to just make guns safer and less likely to go off unintentionally. Well, Michael Retsche is one of those people. He's associate professor and the lead scientist for the dynamic grip recognition technology that was invented at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Hi, Michael.
Hi, yeah. Great to be on the show.
Great to have you. And Jim Schaff is vice president of marketing for Yardim Technologies, the developers of a wireless trigger safety application for firearms. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
And Jim, let me start with you. When I was reading about this, getting prepared to talk to you, I thought, I remember trigger locks. That was supposed to be the answer to kids getting their hands on pistols inappropriately. Do we need to be beyond trigger locks now? Are those sort of outdated, obsolete?
Trigger locks are still a very viable and very excellent solution for bringing safety into the home. But there's just all sorts of new technology that'll allow people to get a little bit more control and even get more control when they're not in the home. It's just one of those things. When you have something that locks, the kids always find the keys. And what we're trying to do is bring in a new technology that allows someone who might not be at home to have awareness of what's happening to their firearm and remotely be able to, disable or turn off a firearm so that it can't be fired.
So explain, Jim, what wireless trigger safety does.
So our technology lets you stay connected to your firearm. It gives you pretty much awareness and 24/7 anywhere in the world, understanding of what's happening to your firearm at any time. If it's moving, if someone's handling it without authorization. And if it is, it simply lets you from something as simple as a mobile app to disable a firearm. You can literally engage the trigger safety and keep that firearm from being fired.
Press a button on your iPhone and nobody can fire the gun.
Absolutely. So if you know your kids are at home and there's nobody else there and you get an alert that says, hey, somebody's moving the firearm and it's supposed to be in the locked drawer with the trigger safety or the trigger lock on, it's nice to know that even if the kids were able to get into that locked drawer, they might be able to unlock that trigger safety. So why don't you just remotely disable it so that there can't be an accident in the home?
Michael Retsche, dynamic grip recognition isn't new, but you invented it at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Would you explain how that works, dynamic grip recognition?
Yes. It turns out that anything that you do repeatedly, you commit to habit, or people colloquially call it muscle memory. And so what we did was we put sensors around the grip of a gun. They're like the touchpad sensors on a computer. And those sensors actually detect the hand geometry and pressure pattern as you pull the trigger. So in this case, the gun is locked always except for the teeny fraction of a second just before the trigger, the hammer hits. And in that time, it's decided whether or not your grip is the owner's grip.
The owner's grip. Does it make it hard to loan your gun? I would ask more importantly, if somebody has a gun in the home for protection, I would say I want to be able to fire the gun at an intruder, but I also want my wife to be able to fire it if she has to.
Yeah, well, like any access system you might have seen with that does fingerprint recognition or other things, you can actually register a large number of users into the gun, the entire police squad, if you want. So it doesn't. It's not just one grip that it recognizes. You can put your left hand, your right hand, lots of other grips into the gun. So that's not an issue.
It sounds like cost might be an issue, Michael.
Well, actually, the technology is the same technology that's in a disposable cell phone. So it's processors are very inexpensive, computer memory is very inexpensive, and these touchpad sensors are very inexpensive. So it really wouldn't dramatically increase the cost of a gun. I mean, there obviously is research and development costs that people might try to charge at some point in the early stages, but the parts cost is very low.
Well, before we let you go, Jim Schaff, I got a question for each of you real quick. You know, anytime you talk about anything around guns, even trigger locks were controversial when they first came out. Have you gotten any pushback from gun rights folks or people who just want free access to firearms unfettered by apps or fobs or anything like that?
The more that the understanding of how our technology works, the more acceptance we're seeing from the gun advocates and the gun enthusiasts, because we're providing a lot of value. Gun theft is a major concern, and 80% of all violent crime is committed with stolen firearms. And the ability to understand that if somebody's handling or has taken my weapon without my authorization, somebody's stolen it out of my home, out of my car, and being able to understand where it is, track it, let the authorities find it and recover it, has that added value has really struck home with a lot of the folks that traditionally have been very against smart gun technology. And by offering that value, we've really been seeing a lot of positive feedback from that sector.
All right.
And it's been really encouraging for us.
Okay, that's Jim Schaff, Vice President of Marketing for Yardham Technologies, and also Michael Retsche, Associate Professor of Information Systems at New Jersey Institute of Technology. Thank you both for sharing with us.
Appreciate being on the show.
Thank you.
Well, next up on The Takeaway, we talk about a new campaign funded by the taxpayers of New York City to boost the body image of young girls. Is this money well spent? You've been sharing your stories about how your body image has changed and what's made the difference. From Texas, we got this text. I used to be called anorexic for being so skinny. My metabolism has slowed down and I've filled out, despite being a normal weight. I have to mentally convince myself that I'm pretty because my family now calls me fat. And from Salem, Oregon, when I was younger, I continually compared myself to other women. I grew up and really settled into myself personality-wise. Well, call us at 877-8MYTAKE and weigh in on this question. We always want to hear from you.
The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry. He'll be back tomorrow. Over the years, you know, government-funded organizations have issued public service announcements, many of them iconic, like this one, telling kids to stay off drugs.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
Everybody remembers that one. Well, they've also told us about drunk driving, for instance.
When friends don't stop friends from drinking and driving, friends die from drinking and driving. Friends don't let friends drive drunk.
Well, in New York City, the mayor, Michael Bloomberg, is famous now for going after vices in the Big Apple: smoking bans, high cigarette taxes, drugs, and of course those sometimes ridiculed soda ads. Well, there's another public health problem that the Bloomberg administration is targeting on the airwaves. Listen to this.
I feel beautiful when I help others.
When I play with my friends.
I feel beautiful when I score a goal.
We're beautiful the way we are.
That's a new public service announcement from the NYC Girls Project, a public health campaign focused on improving body image of girls in New York City. Now, no doubt it sounds well-intended, but it also raises some questions about the government's role in healthcare and whether body image is indeed a public health issue. And helping us to tease it out is Samantha Levine, who conceived the NYC Girls Project. Hi, Samantha.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Joining us also, Emily Rem. She's managing editor of Bust Magazine, a magazine that covers news and culture from a feminist perspective. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how's it going?
Very good. Well, Samantha, let's start with you. Describe what the campaign is and why you decided to push it forward in New York City.
It made a lot of sense for New York City to pursue this initiative because body image and self-esteem issues have real health consequences for girls. They have been associated with eating disorders, increased likelihood of obesity, which may seem counterintuitive, increased likelihood of smoking, alcohol abuse, bullying, early onset of sexual activity, and teen pregnancy. So in addition to helping girls feel better about themselves, there is a definite reason for a health intervention.
And Samantha Levine, you're ready for this question because it comes up almost every time the Bloomberg administration takes on one of these issues, especially with ads or laws. You're telling people how to live. You're getting the city into people's private emotions, their private decisions, and their private lives.
I don't think this campaign is telling people how to live. Rather, we're putting out there information that will help girls feel better about themselves, that will help them believe that their value comes from who they are and what they do as opposed to their appearance. And it also puts out there images that counter the traditional idea, or rather ideal, of what is beautiful, which was very important to us.
Emily Rems from Bust Magazine, you ride the subways, I assume, in New York City, and you watch television, and you also think about body image and about girls' issues. The motivations are definitely noble. Can a PSA work? Can this actually work to help solve the problem?
I think bringing it into the public conversation is valuable, for sure. The way that it's brought into the public conversation, I think, can really determine the value overall. And that's why I have some issues with the fact that the tagline is "I'm beautiful the way I am." If the emphasis of the campaign is supposed to be that value comes from character, then, you know, the use of that very loaded term "beautiful," which is so often used as the baseline of worth for girls in a way that it's not at all used for boys, I think it gives a mixed message. It reinforces the idea that girls' worth comes from beauty as opposed to the other elements of their character.
That beauty is still the priority, even if other things qualify as beautiful.
Right.
Well, then the question then becomes, let's take an 11 or 12-year-old girl riding the subway or watching television after school. We heard that ad. You've been a 12-year-old girl before. I haven't, so I have to ask you, can seeing positive images in girls scoring goals or helping others really help change the way you think if you just go to the schoolyard the next day and experience the same pressures?
I was thinking about this specifically. I was, you know, an 11, 12-year-old girl being tormented because of my appearance. So it's definitely an issue that I can connect to very directly. I don't know if, while living that experience, if seeing an ad of some other girl being called beautiful would necessarily resonate with me, but I can see how it might change the approach of maybe the adults in that girl's life who may also be contributing to that body pressure. There could be authority figures or other adults in that girl's life who see the campaign and maybe adjust their way of interacting with a girl who might be having body image issues, and that could bring about a lot of really positive change.
Samantha Levine, this is your project, and I know that you've thought about this. The intentions are definitely laudable. Is there a good evidence that any of these campaigns, like the Your Brain on Drugs, the most famous one of all time, actually help lower risk in these public health issues? Do they work? Can they?
If this becomes anywhere near as famous as Your Brain on Drugs, we will have succeeded far beyond our wildest expectations. This campaign is trying to do two very concrete things. First, we are trying to help girls believe that their appearance doesn't define them, but we are also very concretely trying to expand the definition of beauty, and we very deliberately chose to use the word beautiful in this campaign. Only 2% of women will describe themselves as beautiful. And we think it's very important that girls stop comparing themselves to a manufactured idea of beauty and embrace their own inner and external beauty. And we wanted to put out there images of real girls calling themselves beautiful so that the girls who ride the subways, who ride the buses and walk on the streets see images of themselves reflected back at them saying, I'm beautiful, and that hopefully they'll then internalize that and say, wow, she looks like me. She says she's beautiful, so am I. I don't need to look like that model or that woman on TV. I can be beautiful the way I am.
So it sounds like, Samantha Levine, that Emily's criticism of the word beautiful, you're saying that beauty as a concept is always going to be important to girls. We're going to redefine what beauty means. It doesn't mean your hair or what size dress you wear. It can mean what kind of person you really are.
It can be what kind of person you really are. And it doesn't have to be the particular image that someone else has decided it is.
Emily Rems, how does that strike you?
It strikes me as a noble ideal. I would flip it around and think young boys also have self-esteem issues around different qualities. Would it be equally applicable to have a boy in an ad that says, like, I'm a leader, I'm adventurous, I'm outgoing, I'm beautiful the way I am? Like, you would never see an ad that way. And I think the fact that it's being so specifically targeted towards girls in a way that it would never be targeted towards boys means it needs some more examination.
Well, girls in New York City, on the subways, on the buses, and at home watching television, have a new message from the Bloomberg administration. You're beautiful just the way you are. Samantha Levine is in charge of that project, the NYC Girls Project, and Emily Rems, managing editor of Bust Magazine, joined us as well. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Caroline from New York, New York. When it comes to body image, I really think age is a factor with whether or not you're comfortable, because older people tend to always look at older photos of themselves and think that they felt or looked a lot better when they were younger. So I think the older you get, the more comfortable you get.
You're calling in on the idea of image, and from Eugene, Oregon, we got this. I love my jiggles and rolls more than ever. This body gave birth to a big, healthy, strong baby. Give us your take at 8778MyTake. Send us your tweets at The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. John Hockenberry's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper, with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.